The following program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery. Cane Vineyard and Winery supports Heritage Radio and the growing movement to change how Americans eat and how we think about our planet. For more information, visit www.cane5.com.
Hi, this is Bernie Wides back on the air with the Naturalist Show, and one of my terrific guests is back this week, Judith Weiss, who is on the faculty of Rutgers and who now has PhD candidates doing articles. It's terrific, and she showed me a new article in Bioscience magazine on fiddler crabs. Really looked like an interesting one to read. Those are really cute little guys, those fiddler crabs. So, Judy, say hi, and we'll get started. We'll continue from last week.
Hi. I'm happy to keep talking about fish.
Oh, sure.
Today.
Okay, so I think we covered the waterfront pretty much on what fishes look like, how they live, and all that stuff. I think there was one other little topic on reproduction. We spoke about that some fish don't need a mate to reproduce.
We did talk about that. End of the
Yeah, and you mentioned some lizards are the same thing. That's right. Okay, so I think what we're going to talk about now is some other things that we're all involved in is eating fish. Fish as food and the problems that have come up and what to do about it, about conservation, fish farming, and taking care of our waterways and all that. So, Judy, how should we start this discussion? What do you think?
We can talk about
any of these things, right?
I guess maybe starting with eating them might be a reasonable place to start.
So fishes are really good food, right?
Fishes are good food. They've got vitamins, they've got minerals, they've got omega-3 fatty acids, which are supposed to be very good for your heart health and also very good for developing fetuses. So it's recommended that pregnant women eat fish. So fish can be very good for you. Fish can also, some fish under certain circumstances, give you problems. Some of the very large fish, like tuna and swordfish, can accumulate through the food chain contaminants so that you may find elevated levels of chemicals like mercury, mm-hmm. PCBs, in these very large fish.
Right. So let's just talk about the food chain for a minute, because a lot of people know the word food chain, but are not familiar with it. So give us a sample of an ocean food chain. Just simplified.
Photosynthesis starts out in the ocean with tiny microscopic plants that take sunshine and carbon dioxide and mm-hmm. in the presence of sunlight turn it carbon dioxide and water into sugars, mm-hmm. which is the nutrition, you know, carbohydrates. And then these tiny plants are eaten by some very small animals called zooplankton. The zooplankton are eaten by little fish that get eaten by middle-sized fish that get eaten by big fish.
Okay.
It doesn't keep going on forever. There are limited number of steps in a food chain. But some kinds of contaminants will build up at each step of the food chain so that there'll be very low levels in the plants and somewhat higher levels in the zooplankton, and somewhat more in the small fish, and somewhat more in the middle-sized fish, and more in the big fish. So the big fish are going to have the highest levels of things like methylmercury or PCBs, the biggest fish, the oldest, biggest fish.
They've been eating a long time.
And that have been accumulating these chemicals from all their food all these years. Mm-hmm. So that very large tuna and swordfish are, even though they've never been living in a polluted environment, will still have accumulated these chemicals. So eating a whole lot of those kind of fish could be not good for you. I wouldn't say never eat tuna fish, but I wouldn't recommend eating tuna fish every day.
Yeah.
I wouldn't recommend little kids eat tuna fish every day because the mercury is a neurotoxin. It's methyl mercury, and it's a neurotoxin. But having tuna fish sometimes is fine.
Mm-hmm.
And then other issues about eating fish other than contaminants, eating sushi could be problematical at times because eating raw fish, fish may have parasites that may be able to be transmitted. Fortunately, most of the fish that we have as sushi are marine fish rather than freshwater fish,
mm-hmm.
and marine fish have fewer parasites to worry about. So this is not, you know, something to worry about, but I guess I wouldn't recommend eating sushi every day either.
Right, nothing every day.
Except
oatmeal, maybe, is all right.
Right, vegetables, vegetables and fruits. And then another issue about eating fish is a kind of interesting that certain species of puffer fish accumulate poison toxin in their tissues. And these so-called fugu puffers are a major delicacy in Japan.
Oh, yes.
Where there are special fugu chefs that prepare the fish properly so the diner gets, you know, the right amount of a tingly, I think, feeling high type sensation, but doesn't keel over dead from it.
Right.
But it's a very thin line.
That's right.
So
you have to have a very sharp knife for that thin line.
And so this is, you know, it's the same. I guess people do that. It's the same as going skydiving or,
yes,
or something like that.
Gets the adrenaline up a little bit.
A risky kind of gives you some kind of rush or something.
Right.
But, you know, I can live fine without eating fugu puffers.
Yeah, but, you know, I've eaten blowfish, which are the same family.
But they're not
they?
Toxic, and but they're delicious.
You have to be careful with those, too, as they do have some accumulation. I think they produce some toxins, but you just eat the tail meat.
The meat. You're just not eating internal organs. Where,
right,
but people generally don't eat internal
so
organs of fish anyway.
When you clean the fish, you just have to keep the tails, which are the meat anyhow. And I think they call it sea chicken or sea squab. Sea squab, yeah. I used to catch them all the time and just eat the tails. It was fine. I'm still here, so it was fine. So that's that family, the puffer family. If you're not familiar with it, they're called puffers or blowfish because they take in, as a defensive thing, right? They take in a lot of air.
Right,
and maybe water, and they swell up into a ball.
Right.
And we used to throw them around like a ball.
Yeah, they're kind of cute.
Kind of cute with that funny face with the big teeth, right? Mm. Okay, so that's one example of a fish that you have to be careful eating. And the one that Judy was talking about, the fugu, which is mostly a Japanese thing. But you know they're raising fugu in Japan now.
They're culturing
them. They're culturing them because it's such a thing to do.
It's still value. Yeah. Still a thing to do. There are other fish that are found on menus and are not a health issue, but kind of an ecological conservation issue, which is certain kinds of fishes that have become very scarce because of overfishing that are still found on menus. The bluefin tuna, for example.
Mm-hmm.
The bluefin tuna throughout the world has plummeted. And, you know, they are endangered species, really.
Mm-hmm.
And yet you still find them on menus, which enrages me. that they should be still, you know. The problem is that when there's a fish species that lives in local waters, a particular country or state can regulate it and prohibit fishing for this species.
Right.
But an oceanic species like tuna that roams across the Atlantic, across the Pacific.
Right, wide-ranging.
There's no one country can, it requires an international agreement. And there is an International Commission for Conservation of Tunas, but it's totally ineffectual. So tunas continue to be
overfished.
It's bluefin tuna.
Mainly bluefin,
That is decimated, and then you still see them, you know, going for them, and, mm-hmm. and you still find them on the menu.
Yes.
And, you know, it gives me great pain. And there are some others that are also problem. Fishes that live a long life tend to be ones that will become reproductive at a late age. You know, mm-hmm. fish that will not reproduce till it's 10 years old.
Yeah, slow-growing fish.
Slow-growing, long-living.
Mm-hmm.
Fishes, there's a fish called an orange roughy.
Oh, yes, right, right.
That's a relatively new name. It used to be called a slime fish.
Yeah, well,
now if you wouldn't,
nobody's going to eat a slime fish.
Exactly. Right. So they changed the name to right. make it sound appetizing. This is a slow-growing type fish that is population's depleted,
mm-hmm.
and you still see them. Then there's now called Chilean sea bass. Mm-hmm. Used to be called the Patagonian toothfish,
right?
Right, that's not appetizing name either, so you change that name. And that's another one in that situation. Sturgeons are scarce these days. So there are certain species of fish that are, you know, for ecological reasons, I would urge people not to eat.
So how do you know which ones? You have... I know some organizations put out little cards.
There are cards, little brochures put out by various organizations, including the Monterey Bay Aquarium, including, I think, Environmental Defense Fund, and I think Blue Ocean Institute.
Blue Ocean, yeah. Mm.
So there are ways of finding out. You can go on the internet and find out. You know, so they put out a list of... green, yellow, and red. The green this is fine to eat. The yellow is, well, it's okay, but, you know, there's some problems. And red is, you know, please don't eat these. These aren't very
They're really
bad
endangered.
Shape. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's, it's becoming a bigger problem all the time because more and more people want the protein.
People want
the fish.
To eat fish.
There are more and more people on Earth. So there's a big... need for
Precisely.
Protein.
Precisely. And so you have many species that have declined considerably. The way they calculate how much they've declined is generally inaccurate because you don't really know what the baseline was. You don't know what the population used to be.
Mm-hmm.
So many things that we think are only maybe 50% of what they used to be, maybe much less than that,
mm-hmm.
because we don't really know what they started out as. There are also issues of fishing having to do with the equipment that we use, pulling nets through the water or having long lines, which is a long line is you know, a sort of commercial equivalent of an angler with a fishing line and a hook, bait on the hook. This is, instead of having one hook and with bait, you're having a line that's perhaps 10 miles long with thousands
of hooks.
Or pulling nets through the water or having traps. These are all techniques that are non-selective, so it catches whatever is there.
Bycatch, it's called.
Bycatch is right. The stuff... that may be far more than half of what you get.
Mm-hmm.
That's not what you're going for.
Yes, and once they hook them or put them in the net...
They're dead.
They're dead. Even if
you can't bring them in,
no.
You're going to throw them back and they're dead. You're not allowed to harve to bring them in because that's not what you're licensed to catch.
Mm.
So this is such a wasteful,
mm-hmm.
so extremely wasteful, this bycatch issue. And a lot of the bycatch may be... the species you're going for, but they're too small. They're not the legal size yet, and they're never going to be because they're dead.
Mm.
They'll never grow to be full size. So you have a variety of issues like that. So fishing has had enormous impacts on fish populations, not only the so-called targeted species, but non-target species that get
caught up
in it. So you've really changed the ecosystem. You also have reduced the size of the fish. You know, if you're going after the biggest ones,
mm-hmm.
you're losing the biggest ones out of your population.
And those are the reproducers.
Those are the ones that are the major, what they call the big old fat females, B-O-F-F, are the...
Is that the scientific term that you guys use?
Yeah, okay. Yeah. The BOFs are the, you know, the big contributors to the next generation.
Right.
And you take them away and you're left with smaller females who are going to not only put out far fewer eggs, but the quality of their eggs aren't as good either.
Mm-hmm.
So you're having major impacts on the next generation,
yeah,
by changing the size structure of the population. You know, you're just not getting the big ones anymore. And there are pictures that you can see of, you know, people photographed with the big fish that they caught. You know,
oh,
and
yes,
the trophy fishes.
Fish, right.
And it's pitiful. You see a comparison of the fish that were winning trophies 50 years ago, 60 years ago, and the fish that are winning trophies now.
Right, they're no more 1,200-pound tunas,
you know,
to catch.
They're not. Those big fish aren't here anymore.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you see these comparisons, and it, you know, picture is worth 1,000 words, and it's
yeah,
pitiful.
You think they're the same guys who have trophy wives? What do you think?
The trophy fish. It's really, really sad.
It is. Okay, so... What can we do about it?
Well, let me just... I just
okay,
thought of one other thing.
Go ahead.
Some of the fishing techniques, like trawling along the bottom, damages the habitat on the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
People can visualize and see what happens when you clear cut a forest. The whole forest is destroyed. You don't generally see a picture of what the sea bottom looks like before trawls come and after.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the same thing. It mows down these trawls with heavy wheels that run along the bottom, mow down structure like corals and things that may be on the bottom. And that structure, that's habitat.
Yeah,
that's for
right,
fish, for also invertebrates, for all sorts of things. And the trawls go by and mow it all down. It's just like clear-cutting a forest.
And it may take 100 years to recover, or 1,000 years to recover.
Yes.
That's true.
So it's the method of fishing.
The technology has
gotten
changed.
Better, meaning
so
it catches
good that we
fishes
can catch
better,
right,
and it destroys the habitat better.
Yeah.
And
yes, I'll give you a little example. When I worked in a in a marine science program, we had a boat and we trawled on Long Island Sound. We took kids out and did a marine ecology program. And we had a miniature otter trawl. Now, the otter trawl isn't that bad because you can trawl along the bottom or you can trawl a little above the bottom.
Right.
It had doors to keep the net open.
Mm-hmm.
These are like wings to keep it open. And a tickler chain in the middle. And the tickler chain was made, if there was a flounder that was down in the bottom, the tickler chain would wake up, so the flounder would start
to swim up. So it would go into
the net. And he'd swim into the net. And we caught everything in that net, so I can imagine a huge trawler, commercial size, you know, catches everything and destroys the bottom. We'd pull up sponges and everything
right, the
else.
The commercial
yeah,
size trawlers now
factory
are
ships,
up
right?
So big that yeah, you can fit, I think I saw a diagram, you can fit like a dozen 747 airplanes in one.
It's like a big aircraft carrier.
Envision that.
Size.
And that's what's sweeping along the bottom.
Mm. And then they process the fish right on the ship.
Which is
sure,
good. I mean, once
yeah,
you've got them, you can process them, freeze them, whatever, so
right,
you don't have loss by spoilage.
Yeah.
This is a good thing. But
so
you
what,
know,
what should we tell the average person to do then? It's a problem. It's a two-edged sword here.
It so is. What can you tell the average person to do? Well,
and tell them right now.
If you have a home aquarium, focus on freshwater fishes because freshwater fishes in home aquariums are generally cultured. They're raised, whereas most reef aquarium fishes and the corals that you get are taken out of the natural world.
You don't mean to eat them. You mean to, as an aquarium,
right?
In your
right,
house.
As aquarium. I'm
okay,
starting with the home aquarium.
Oh, okay, that's the easiest.
I guess
thing
I should have started with the eating. Yeah, it's a non sequitur, I guess. But yeah. So, marine aquariums for home aquariums are generally things that have been caught from a reef.
They haven't been raised.
They haven't been raised the way freshwater species are. They have been caught, and sometimes caught using dynamite fishing, which has been, which destroys the reef itself, or cyanide, which kills a lot of those kind of things.
Right.
So that's one thing. When it comes to feed, to eating, try to get a hold of the list of which fishes are fine and eat off the green list. Generally speaking, smaller species are fine, and the fish that get real large are not, as a general rule. Go after lionfish. Find Asian carp. There's another invasive species in the Mississippi River, and hopefully not getting into the Great Lakes. Mm-hmm. Go after them. What else? Yeah, I mean, eating lower down on the food chain is always good.
That means a smaller,
and you don't have to
fish.
Eat that much fish. Mm-hmm. Eat you know, more vegetables and fruits.
You know, this is really a foodie network that we're on.
Right.
So my show is an exception, but when it comes to fish, people have a problem because they don't know what to do. That's why I said they have to give them advice and try to stick to it. It's very difficult because you go out to eat in a fish restaurant, any restaurant, you look at the menu, and invariably there's Chilean sea bass on it, right?
Yes.
And I once went up to the manager and I said, why do you have this on the menu? He says, what's wrong with it? I said, this is an endangered species. I said, do you have the sea bass in the kitchen? I'd like to see the tag on it. He said, what are you talking about? Because when we were in Antarctica, one of the crewmen on our ship was from the Falklands, where they catch a lot of Chilean sea bass. And he said, everyone that's caught in the Falklands is tagged where it came from. And they have a quota, because most of them are pirated.
Right.
Because, as you said, with the restrictions, nobody checks up on it, really.
And there's a lot of error in fish markets, so things that are called one species that turn out to be another species.
They use a local name or a different name.
Right.
So that's a problem. I just stopped eating Chilean sea bass, period. It's a delicious fish, but, you know, there are enough other fishes in the sea.
There's enough fish that are in reasonable population size.
Yeah.
So there's no easy answer. There are some things that have been happening that... You're looking like we're ready to...
Yeah, we're going to take a break in a minute. Then after, let's talk about aquaculture.
Talk about aquaculture and other things.
Other methods, too.
Yeah.
So there's the music. And folks, we're going to talk about aquaculture coming up and some great fish stories that I have, because I like to tell a lot of stories. So stay tuned. And I'm sure Judith has some stories, too.
I want to talk about marine protected areas.
Okay.
And
that's good.
The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Join Linda Palacio for A Taste of the Past every Thursday at 12 p.m. as she indulges her curiosities about food, cooking, drinking, and dining of the past by taking a journey through culinary history.
Linda interviews authors, scholars, friends, and chroniclers to learn about what was eaten, where, and how, from as long ago as ancient Mesopotamia and Rome, right up to the grazing tables and deli counters of today. The show underscores food as a lively link between present and past cultures. Again, that's Thursday at 12 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
Hi, this is Bernie Wides back on the air with the program The Naturalist, and it's a second program on our two-program series on fish. And my great guest today is Judith Wiss, who's a professor at Rutgers University in New Jersey. And her new book is just coming out called Do Fishes Sleep? And we covered that topic in our first show last week, so tune into both shows. And if you have any questions or comments, just send it to us at heritageradionetwork.com, or our show is now on Facebook, and you can make a comment. And if I can't answer it, I'll get it back to Judith. So, Judith, we're talking about ways that we can help the fish populations, you know, and methods of conservation and all that stuff. And we haven't mentioned fish farming or aquaculture at all. So you want to start off with that?
Yes. Aquaculture is becoming more and more of a significant part of the way in which we get our seafood. It used to be a very small fraction. Fish culture actually goes back a very long time. The Asian countries have been doing freshwater fish farming for centuries. Mm-hmm. And good fish farming really involves a lot of trial and error to learn, you know, what the best food is for the species you're raising. And perhaps you can raise more than one species in the same pond. And a lot of trial and error has led to very good freshwater aquaculture in many Asian countries. It's much newer here, only several decades, really. And I think in the freshwater side, catfish farming in the South is a pretty successful.
Yes, and the catfish taste better than they used to, surprisingly. They don't have that muddy taste that they used to have.
Right.
What are they feeding them? They're feeding them soybean?
They're feeding... I'm not sure exactly.
Some kind of soy protein.
I don't really know. But that seems to... You know, freshwater in a contained pond, mm-hmm. freshwater aquaculture, has a lot of advantages because you're in a contained system.
Right.
And it's also on a particular person's property. So they're in charge of it. They own this land. When you get into marine aquaculture, you run into issues of who owns the coastal water.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not like a pond on somebody's own property. So
yeah,
you get into ownership issues and conflicting uses of a coastal water area. Some marine aquaculture can be done on land in very large tanks.
Right.
You know, this is one method. And then the issues there are how to deal with the waste coming out of the fish farm or whatever chemicals might be used in terms of antibiotics that might mm-hmm. be used or other things.
On the fish.
On the fish. Fish farming isn't all that different from farming land animals that you need, you use antibiotics, you may use pesticides or something. And so there's issues of contamination coming from the farm.
Mm-hmm.
Just as we have issues of fertilizers and pesticides coming from
regular farms,
we have the same sorts of issues coming from fish farms.
Right, but there are newer ones now that are self-contained. There's one up the Hudson River in Hudson, New York, that's completely self-contained.
All right, this is good.
No waste off. They recycle the water and all that. I'm going to go visit them in a couple of months.
Okay, I'd like to go visit them too.
Okay.
This is a good approach because most of the ones that are out there now are not self-contained.
Right.
And have issues of waste products. The largest one that people are concerned about is the salmon. Mm-hmm. Now, these are not raised on land in big tanks. These are floating, huge cages out in the water. And so what you have with the salmon culture is issues of wastes. The fish are pooping all the time, and it goes to the bottom, and you may have, you know, highly polluted areas with basically sewage, mm-hmm. a fish sewage accumulating below, unless they're located in an area with strong currents.
Yeah, tidal currents.
If the currents are strong, mm-mm. it'll dilute it and blow it
yes.
away.
We saw one in Canada like that.
You see this in Canada, yeah. in mm-hmm. Scotland, yeah. in both coasts of Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And Chile,
yeah, Chile
is doing salmon farming in a big way. You've got issues of antibiotics. In Chile, they overused antibiotics so that you end up with bacteria that are resistant to the antibiotics and viruses. And, you know, they wiped out a whole lot of their fishes because of misuse of antibiotics.
Right.
In Chile, just within the past year or two.
Uh-huh.
So maybe they'll learn their lesson.
Hopefully, because they were shipping a lot of fish. A lot of the fish that yeah. we ate came from Chile.
Right.
I used to see the styrofoam boxes, and okay. it said from Chile. And also, they would add carotenoids.
To make them pinker.
To make them pinker.
Because the farmed fish don't look as pink as...
They don't look as pink as wild salmon, who
right.
eat crustaceans, and they
right.
get the carotenoids.
Another issue with raising salmon is parasites. They have... parasites called sea lice that live on, and the young ones can be a significant source of mortality for baby salmon. And what happens is the parasites can jump from the farmed salmon, since the farmed salmon aren't just in cages, floating in the natural water. The parasites can jump onto wild salmon that are moving in the vicinity.
Yeah,
and so that's been another issue of concern, is the parasites now getting transmitted from the farmed fish onto the wild fish. And then yet another one issue of raising a species that's a carnivore is that you're feeding them, what are you doing? You're catching middle-sized fish or small fish from the ocean to turn into fish meal to feed to the farmed salmon. So what mm-hmm. you're taking out is huge amounts, far more poundage of these food, so-called forage fish
mm-hmm.
removed from the ocean than you'll ever get pounds of salmon at the end of the farm.
What's the ratio of for 1 pound of salmon?
I think it's at three-something,
three,
four.
I don't really know, but the trophic levels and...
But what it is you're taking out a lot more pounds of these smaller fishes to turn into food for the salmon than you're going to ever get the salmon. And those are now no longer available for food for the wild.
For everybody else out there.
For the wild species that are living out there.
Yeah.
So that's another issue. So there is a lot of research going on to try to develop artificial... you know, soybean-based or some other kind of... if you can turn them into vegetarians or at least partial vegetarians.
Partially, like soy. They're using a lot of soy protein.
They are trying to see if you can do that. And there's a group somewhere overseas, Australia maybe, Japan, trying to do aquaculture of bluefin tuna.
Oh, yes. I've heard about
and
that.
And trying to see if you can get them to be vegetarians.
Yeah.
I'm skeptical that they will become total vegetarians, but if you can at least get them to be half and half vegetarians, you're doing better.
Yes, and also I remember the krill catch in Antarctica is humongous, and I think they're using that to make fish food as well as human food.
They're taking
from the krill.
Food away from the whales. Cause
that's
the
right,
and
the whales
on the krill.
The whales have made a comeback, but now the krill crop is being overfished. So there's going to be less food
for the
baleen whales who eat almost exclusively krill.
Clearly, aquaculture is not a panacea to the problems of overfishing. Aquaculture is, I think, has a potential of being very positive.
Yes.
But currently, it's got some problems that need to be worked on. And I would think aquaculture of species that are herbivorous rather than species that are carnivorous mm-hmm. would be ecologically much yeah. sounder.
How about the ones that St. Peter's fish, tilapia.
Tilapia.
That's a freshwater fish.
That's a freshwater fish.
Is it a herbivore fish? I don't know.
I think it is.
Probably
I think
is.
It's a... Yes, I think it's a filter feeder.
A filter feeder? I don't really know.
I don't really know yeah. offhand. But, yeah, so there
That's
are...
been successful.
Freshwater fishes have been overall more successful yeah. than marine fish. I mean, depending on what your definition of successful is.
Right, right.
Yeah. So I don't know if there's anything else to say about aquaculture.
Okay,
I have,
that, but it's growing, it's spreading.
It's growing. It's become,
it's
I think,
become a major
about
business.
50% yeah. of our food fish now.
As our wild populations raised. Decline and there's more and more regulations, I think aquaculture is going to get bigger and bigger
oh,
and
yeah.
bigger.
Absolutely.
And wherever you go now, I mean, we were in Turkey, and I was driving in the bus through Turkey. There you go. There are fish farms and all the lakes.
Mm-hmm.
And we stopped at a restaurant that they were raising trout right out the window. It was terrific. I mm-hmm. mean, the trout was delicious. So I think, as you're saying, that it's on the increase more and more. And that's one solution, maybe, to overfishing the oceans and the rivers and the lakes.
If it can be
but,
as
made,
you say, improved and made
Yeah, you have to make it a closed system.
And not deplete the forage fish out
right.
of the ocean
yeah.
to feed the farmed fish.
Right. And then there's shrimp now. We get a lot of shrimp from Thailand, and what they're doing is cutting down the mangroves to make way for their
shrimp
farming. But so you buy shrimp now, you see over more than half of it is from farming already.
Mm-hmm.
Even though we still catch wild shrimp off the Georgia coast and Florida. So there's all kinds of problems, but seafood is such a great food source, and I love it. I eat fish all the time and everything else connected with the seas. That hopefully there'll be enough fish around. So what we're going to do is we're going to stop for a short break.
Okay.
And then, we're going to stop right now. Right, Jack?
Yeah.
For a break. Okay, we'll be back in a few minutes for the second half of the show.
All right.
Hi, we just have a minute left for the show. I forgot that we are already doing the second half. And Judith just reminded we didn't talk about marine reserves, which is a very important part of conservation.
And, I have a minute to
and talk. Jack, is that it? 1 minute.
Just very quickly, marine reserves are, I think, the best idea happening these days, which is setting aside part of the ocean for no fishing at all and comparable to national parks where you don't go hunting. And in marine reserves, they have found that not only do the fish recover within the reserve, but the fish don't know the boundaries of the reserve, so you get better fishing outside the reserve.
Okay.
So these are being developed around the world, and if anything is going to save fisheries, it will be
marine reserves. Okay, I hope we can get that on the air too, Jack. So we're going to sign off right now. I want to thank Judith for coming today. And maybe in the future she'll make another guest appearance.
Sure.
And
happy.
And this is the Naturalist Show signing off.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from Just Food. Help bring live chickens into food challenge communities through your donations to the Just Food City Chicken Project 2011. The City Chicken Project would not be possible without the volunteer hours, donations large and small, and the vibrant energy and ideas of the communities we work with. Just Food is a nonprofit organization that connects New York City communities and local and urban farmers with the resources and support they need to make fresh, locally grown food accessible to all. To donate, search on Kickstarter.com for Just Food and find their City Chicken Project. For more information on Just Food, visit justfood.org or call 212-645-9880. That's 212-645-9880. Let's keep making New York City a better place to live and eat. There's no problem that Dave Arnold can't solve on his show, Cooking Issues. Take a little listen.
So Naveen writes in and says, "Hi Dave, I'm fascinated by chocolate, especially the transformation from the bitter seeds of the cacao tree to a tasty chocolate bar. That is a very interesting transformation. Are there any other foods that undergo a similar set of steps, fermentation, roasting, grinding? Also, do you know of any other tropical fruit seeds that could become delicious through such a process? Thanks, Naveen." That's an interesting question. I mean, obviously coffee, right? Coffee goes through a similar set of procedures, quite literally, fermentation, drying, roasting, grinding, brewing. Vanilla goes through picking, fermentation, right? It's dipped in, usually in boiling water, and then wilted, and then fermented. So it's similar, and then I guess it can be ground to form a paste. But vanilla doesn't taste like vanilla until it goes through its paces to be fermented. In fact, the vanilla that's uncured is called red vanilla. You can get it. It's interesting.
If you like what you hear, you can hear a new show every Tuesday at noon on the Heritage Radio Network, or subscribe to the podcast, or check out the archives on our website.
This is Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer. This week, I came across a new website from the American Meat Institute and the American Meat Scientists Association. It's called www.meatmythcrushers.com. It purports to be addressing consumer concerns about additives such as sodium nitrates in your, ham and turkey roll and whatever, and animal welfare and food safety. I noticed as I went through the Meat Myth Crushers website, however, that it did not address anything like subtherapeutic antibiotic use in the meat chain. So I'm not sure how many myths they intend to crush. But, you know, as I always say, it's good to know what the opposition is thinking. And if you want to be fair about any issues around the food scene, it's wise to keep up with their press as well as ours. That's it for Behind the Scenes Food News with Katie Kiefer.